It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today political editor Paul Singer. Today, he's going to share his findings that Congress is expanding its press offices while decreasing legislative staff.
First, the Federal Trade Commission announced yesterday that they're pursuing legal action against cell provider T-Mobile. The FTC claims that the company scammed customers out of hundreds of millions of dollars by adding what they call bogus charges onto customers' bills.
It's a practice evidently known as cramming, which the FTC has been trying to crack down on in recent years. But T-Mobile's CEO is defending the company, saying the charges are unfounded and without merit.
Brendan Sasso joins us now. He's a technology correspondent for National Journal. Brendan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
So it seems like T-Mobile has some mud on its face right now. This is a company that purports to be consumer-friendly, taking on the giants, and yet they've got these allegations about bogus fees going on. What's happening?
Right. It doesn't look great for T-Mobile. They try to advertise themselves as the uncarrier. They're the smallest of the four cell phone carriers. So they try to seem like they're cooler than the evil AT&T and Verizon. But here they're being accused by the government of overbilling customers. And it's not just a few isolated incidents. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And what they say is, you know, that, I mean, and this isn't that, these aren't just charges that T-Mobile is putting on out of the blue. These are third parties that are requesting that T-Mobile add the charges, but T-Mobile got a good cut out of the amount of money of these extra services that people allegedly didn't even want.
So they're getting a kickback from these, but how did it work? How did these charges end up showing up on people's bills in the first place?
Well, I think sometimes people, you click on an ad online and you think you're going to win a prize for a free iPad or something. And, you know, in a lot of cases, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And a lot of these companies get your phone number, and then they just add that. They sign you up for some service that you didn't want. And sometimes these companies just go around and buy lists of phone numbers. So even if you're a consumer who did nothing wrong, you end up with fees on your phone bills. And in a lot of cases, people don't even know that they don't notice the bills. They notice the charges on their bills. So there's nothing they can do about it because they don't even know that they're getting charged for it.
Well, so how did they get found out?
So the FTC has been doing an investigation. They brought cases against other companies, usually the third parties that are putting the charges on there. This is their first big case against the actual phone company itself. So the FTC did their investigation. They found a lot of these fees that were buried in people's bills. They, according to the FTC, T-Mobile, even when it should have become aware that a lot of these fees were bogus, didn't really do anything to remove them or refund consumers.
Now, you said the process is called cramming. I'm only familiar with that term as regards to, you know, college. You're studying for a paper or something late. So what exactly is cramming?
That's just the word that they use to describe adding these unwanted charges on phone bills. And it's been a problem for a while on landline bills, but it's becoming more of a problem on mobile phone bills. It's a little more complicated to catch on mobile phones because people sometimes do sign up for extra services for their mobile phone. That might be something that they would want to have added to their phone bill. But in a lot of cases, this one was, you know, horoscope information, flirting tips, celebrity gossip, and things that people didn't actually want. And I'm not even sure in most cases whether they got sort of any service at all. They just got these charges.
So what kind of action is the FTC likely to take against T-Mobile?
So they're going to court. They said they had settlement negotiations but weren't able to reach an agreement with T-Mobile. So they want to get refunds for consumers, and so this would be hundreds of millions of dollars potentially that they could try to get back to people. The FTC doesn't actually have fining authority, so there's no way they can really punish T-Mobile beyond forcing them to refund consumers. But the FCC, that's the Federal Communications Commission, has launched its own investigation. And the FCC does have fining authority, so it's possible if the FCC concludes that there were violations here, they could bring their own action where T-Mobile could face further punishment.
T-Mobile has sort of billed itself as this maverick company that's trying to shake things up, take on the giants. How damaging is this going to be for them ultimately with its customers?
I mean, it's hard to say. They're struggling already in the marketplace. You know, their network isn't as good as AT&T and Verizon, and that's something that a lot of people want. But they try to cut costs, and they try to offer people plans that, you know, are more competitive. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not sure, you know, how much publicity this will get. You know, it certainly doesn't look good for them, especially because they have this brand, and it certainly hurts that.
And what does this bigger picture mean for other carriers and I guess the practice of cramming? Do companies have to be more careful now?
Sure. I mean, I think what T-Mobile is saying is, sure, there were probably unauthorized charges on people's bills, but they did what they could to stop it, and it's not really fair for the FTC to be singling them out. And on a press call with reporters, the FTC didn't really answer whether they think other companies are doing this as well. They brought a case against T-Mobile, and they said, you know, they have the evidence for that, but they didn't really say whether other companies are also doing this. So in some ways, at least, it's a warning message to the other companies that they better get in line or they could face similar charges.
As a customer, most of us don't pore over our cell phone bills. Does this mean we need to have a little more buyer beware going on with our cell phone companies and charges?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, in this case, would have been really tough for somebody to find these bills. You know, a lot of times you would look, it was buried under some sort of other category. And when you actually looked at it, it was just a jumble of numbers and letters. But you were supposed to know that was you getting billed for horoscope information. But yeah, I think, you know, if you look at it and all of a sudden you're getting charged an extra $10 a month and you don't know why, it's probably worth trying to figure that out and trying to get the company to cancel it.
So it seems often what happens in cases like this is that the company is kind of contrite. I'm thinking about Target with their data breach. In this case, T-Mobile doesn't seem to be very contrite. They've sort of said, you know, we are handling this and you're being unfair. Are they taking the right approach?
I mean, that's tough to say. I think that, you know, I'm not necessarily the public relations expert, but I think that, you know, if they're going to go to court and they're going to try to fight it, you know, maybe they don't want to be publicly admitting wrongdoing, and who knows, maybe they'll be able to prove that they weren't responsible for this, or maybe their strategy is to just say the other phone companies do it too and they aren't any worse. The CEO, who's pretty famous for his colorful language and tweets, had some interesting tweets after the charges were filed, sort of saying that this is suggesting that this is a conspiracy with the lobbying of big lobbying of the other carriers. And he said, "Hey FTC, did you lose Randall's address?" Referring to Randall Stephenson's, the CEO of AT&T. So I guess they're trying to keep the image that they have as a sort of rebellious upstart, even though they're facing a federal lawsuit.
Interesting. Well, so there's been some talk recently of a merger between T-Mobile and Sprint. What do you think this says about that?
I'm not sure that at the end of the day that it's going to be really critical to that merger. I'm not sure that the antitrust investigation of that would really be informed by this sort of separate legal issue, but you know, it certainly doesn't look good for the companies, and they're trying to. I think that merger would face a lot of resistance from regulators, and so they don't want to be doing anything that looks bad on any front.
Brendan, do you have any parting advice for T-Mobile customers who might be listening?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, customers of any carrier, like you had said, I think it's important to check your bill and probably don't click on those online ads that tell you you can get a free iPad. Don't
fill in your phone
your
number.
Yeah.
Right. No social security numbers. So keep it clean, Brendan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking to Brendan Sasso, a technology correspondent at National Journal.
During the past 3 years, the U.S. House of Representatives has trimmed its committee staff by about 20%, a money-saving measure led by Speaker John Boehner.
During that same time period, however, the chamber increased its press office staff by nearly 15%. The trend suggests a possible emphasis on political messaging over actual legislation and investigation. Central Times weekly congressional expert, USA Today politics editor Paul Singer, reported that story today.
Also in congressional news, today is the 50th anniversary of the passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act. While lawmakers celebrated that anniversary at the Capitol this morning, it raises the question, could today's Congress actually pass that kind of bipartisan legislation? USA Today politics editor Paul Singer joins us now and every week at about this time to hold Congress's proverbial feet to the fire. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Rob? Good to talk to you.
Yeah, well, the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, a lot of talk today about the significance of that. How does it fit into the significance as far as a part of congressional history?
Well, you know, there are moments in congressional history when Congress sort of, you know, rises up to do fairly dramatic things. And keep in mind, the Civil Rights Act was not a standalone piece of legislation, right? There were several other bills around that same time that were passing through Congress, you know, that really dramatically reshaped America. You know, the Voting Rights Act was part of that as well. And, you know, there's this whole Great Society project that that LBJ was driving. Now, of course, there will be people who will argue now that some of those laws have, the time has come and passed for them and they're no longer relevant, whatever. You can, you know, there's a whole series of political arguments to be made. But I think it is very clear that Congress was sort of reshaping the history of the nation at that period of time, which, of course, they're not doing now with a couple of kind of outstanding exceptions. I mean, I think the Health Care Act is the one, the Affordable Care Act is the only thing close to it that's happened in the past, you know, I don't know, decade or so, where a real sweeping piece of social legislation has passed. And even that was almost completely partisan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Civil Rights Act took a lot of across-the-aisle negotiating and agreement. Is there a chance that something like that could happen in today's partisan Congress?
No. I mean, no. The only thing that can pass in a Congress like this is if we're attacked again by terrorists and another Patriot Act is passed. When there's this moment that everyone decides that being American matters more than being whatever party you're defending. But the way Congress operates, there is increasingly little agreement on almost anything. And every bill is an opportunity to message why your opposition, why your opponent party are bad human beings. It's not an opportunity to make major legislation, to make major policy.
You talk to Congress people, do they look back on something like the Civil Rights Act and think maybe wistfully or something like, hey, why can't we do that? Or is that just ancient history?
Yeah, we have these conversations a lot, actually, with members talking about how, oh, remember when we used to all get together and we'd, you know, go out and have dinners together and we'd have these events and stuff and we'd, you know, get to know each other and then we could cooperate across the aisle. I'm not entirely sure it's true, honestly. I mean, there's a lot of social activity still. Members of Congress play in, you know, the annual softball game and the baseball game and the football game and the soccer game. And, you know, they do actually, you know, hang out and get to know each other. But the fact of the matter is that their votes are cooked into a political system that requires them to be as combative as possible. The nation is not currently willing to see people compromise for to achieve big goals. It's just not where we're at as a nation.
Well, let's get into some of how Congress does stuff today. You did a behind-the-scenes article out today looking at maybe a quantifiable trend in Congress of prioritizing political messaging over actual legislating. What did you find?
Well, we started to look at a couple of committees that we thought had, you know, significantly large press operations. And, of course, as we were looking at it, we had to think, well, compared to what? I mean, how big is this press operation? You've got, you know, eight people doing press. Is that a big or a small committee press operation? And so we compared back a few years. What we discovered is that the number of committee staff overall in the House of Representatives has dropped by about 20% since 2010, which is when the Democrats ran the chamber last. There were, at that point, about 1,500 committee staff. Now there's about 1,200 committee staff. But in the same time period, the number of press staff on those committees has risen from about 75 to about 85, and they make up a bigger chunk of the committee's work. We also know that there are other members of staff that talk to the press and do communications as well, and that you can actually count. You can see that Congress is clearly, even as it's trying to save money and cut down on staff and resources, it's clearly emphasizing communications, press, Twitter, Facebook, and sort of just a general talking about itself.
Well, tell us about the people on these committees. Are they neutrals brought in from the outside to do some of the heavy legwork, or are they partisan appointees?
They are all partisan appointees, almost all partisan appointees. There are some exceptions. But you are hired by, usually, you are hired by either the chairman, that is the majority party, or the ranking member of the minority party to serve those members, the Democrats or the Republicans, on that committee. There are a couple of exceptions, and in some cases, they end up hiring, you know, experts in a field, particularly on the defense committees, you'll see this, on the appropriations spending committees, you'll see this. They hire these professional staff members who really are professionals in an area like, you know, I don't know, Mideast peace talks, because you need experts who are able to then tell Congress whether or not they're getting the price they should be getting for buying this particular widget or for, you know, building this weapon system. Some of those folks are nonpartisan, but almost everybody else is a partisan appointee, and the spokespeople, the press people, are entirely partisan.
So you've seen an increasing proportion, even as the overall number is cut, there's more press and communications types in there. You work with these committees as part of your job. You listen to what they say, try to get information from them. Does it feel different? Does it feel less accomplishy, more talky?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that got us started on this is that some of these committees, you know, I mean, they produce very little legislation. They don't have meaningful hearings to move a topic, to move a subject area. And I went back and I looked at some old hearings on both Republican and Democratic committees, you know, hearings about steroids in baseball, hearings about FDA regulation of drugs, hearings even about, you know, the Medicaid donut hole, whatever it is, you know, things that government should be looking at. Are we spending our money properly and things like that? They just don't do much of that anymore. Now they have hearings that say stuff. If it's a Democratic-run hearing, you'll see a hearing about, you know, why Obamacare is good for America. If it's a Republican-run hearing, you'll see why Obamacare is bad for America. I mean, they really become just messaging opportunities.
And so what do they do with it? I mean, is this do they get it up on C-SPAN and talk about it there, or issue lots of press releases?
It's all, I mean, now they have websites that are dedicated to specific investigations. If you go to the Oversight Committee, they have an entire video department that's doing videos, some of which are just no more than two-minute commercials kind of mocking the administration for something or, you know, for a particular policy. They have, you know, Twitter feeds that are designed specifically to address a particular issue. They have Facebook pages and chats and all this stuff. Now, you could argue that all the development of new technology is required these new staff. But there's also an argument that, in fact, the development of new technology requires fewer staff because fewer people could do more with technology. You no longer need to be, you know, typing up a press release and sending it out in the mail. You no longer need to be answering the paper mail. Now, technology allows you to do a lot of this stuff. But yeah, it's a very different, it's a much more proactive kind of thing where these guys are sending press releases, emails, web things, Twitter posts all day long, and almost all of them, Democrats and Republicans, are about why we are good and the other guys are bad.
And all this public relations must be boosting the image of Congress.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's the lowest it's ever been. At the moment, I'm missing my most recent Gallup poll in front of me, but I know the congressional approval ratings amongst the public are, you know, in the low two digits. 10% of people approve of what Congress is doing, you know. And I think part of it is because everybody demonizes everybody else. And so what you hear is not, gosh, I have a disagreement about immigration. Gosh, we need to handle this issue and figure out a way to work it out. It's, gosh, the other guys are trying to destroy America.
Paul, before we let you go, I want to move on briefly. The Mississippi Senate primary done last week. We thought Senator Thad Cochran had won. His challenger isn't quite buying that yet. Just in 40 seconds or so, what's going on there?
Yeah, it's a circus. Chris McDaniel is the Tea Party challenger. They got to a runoff. In the runoff, Thad Cochran managed to win by about 6,000 votes. Part of the way he did that was by reaching out to Democrats, to black voters, to union voters, and asking them to support him in a Republican primary. A bunch of them did. Chris McDaniel is now alleging that a lot of these people voted illegally because they had already voted in a Democratic primary. It just now, as we're on the phone here, there was a Cochran press conference going on today that said that McDaniel has no proof of that, and if he, you know, had proof, he would show it. That press conference call apparently got cut off because some hecklers joined the call. I mean, it's become just a circus. McDaniel is raising money as if he's going to file suit. We'll see whether he does.
We'll be watching Mississippi, I guess. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, have a great fourth, Rob.
You too. That's USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to give us the latest news from Congress. Jeff Miller was an international lawyer with a London bank, and about a decade ago, he and his partner upped stakes and moved to Hayward, Wisconsin to run the local ice cream shop.
In a new book, he tells the story of making a drastic life change and of his love for small towns, the Midwest, and ice cream. Jeff Miller joins us now. He operates West Hayward Dairy and McCormick House Inn. His new book is called Scoop, Notes from a Small Ice Cream Shop. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much.
So in the world of things that change, I mean, this is a seismic change we're talking about. You moving from London, an international lawyer, to a small town ice cream store owner, an inn owner. How did that ever come about?
Well, I am from the area. I grew up outside the Twin Cities, and although I'd lived in London for 12 years and had lived outside the upper Midwest for over 25, I visited periodically, and I had a friend who had a lake home in the Hayward area, a friend from school, and we visited. And after a while, we bought a cabin about 20 miles east of Hayward. And within 6 months of coming back and forth to do some renovations, we saw the ice cream shop was for sale, and we were just having some ice cream. And it was one of those moments when neither of us was very happy with our careers and the stages they were at. And we saw a for sale sign in the window, so we asked ourselves, well, why couldn't we do this? And a few months later, we had sold our home in London, packed everything, and I resigned from Citigroup, the bank I was working for in London, and arrived in Hayward in the beginning of the spring of, and that was 2005.
You describe yourself in the book as someone who's not prone to drastic action. Was this big move out of character for you?
It was out of character. I'd always been driven. Ever since I was young, I'd wanted to see the world, travel, and being a lawyer allowed me to do that. I had worked in New York, London, Hong Kong, and I had achieved something, and I was doing quite well. But there was just something missing. I was no longer happy. I had been with the bank for 9 years, and while I loved London, I'd grown you know, very happy there, and I even became a British citizen. There was a lack of balance, and the work was just becoming all-consuming, and with the creation of the BlackBerry, you really couldn't get away from it. So weekends were no longer free, and the stress and pressure were just a price that was becoming too much. And so, at the same time, I couldn't really do anything else because I didn't really know what else to do, and I didn't really have many other skills. But when we saw that this ice cream shop was for sale, and we automatically saw, you know, signs of ice cream grandeur and Ben and Jerry's, and it had a very lovely kitsch quality in the town. But, you know, we didn't really know Hayward very well, but we had visited the area and it was beautiful. The lakes were amazing, and we knew that, you know, especially in the summer, there were, you know, crowds of people, and that the ice cream shop was a local institution. So we thought, you know, it just seemed clear. It became this blank slate where we could write our, you know, future and success. And the bed and breakfast was really more of an afterthought. We were looking for a place to live in town, and this 7-bedroom Victorian mansion had been on the market for a number of years. And when we saw it, my partner Dean, he decided that it was just, you know, it was made for him, and so that's how we developed the two businesses simultaneously.
Did you have a passion for what you were doing right away, restoring this inn and also serving ice cream, or is it something that you had to build up to and get confident in?
Well, I always liked ice cream, and I in fact, more so as a child, I ate ice cream all the time. I rarely ate my dinner. I would come home from school, and my father had died when I was quite young, so my mother spoiled me and allowed me to do this. So I always enjoyed ice cream, although as I, you know, became an adult, you know, you eat it once in a while, but not much. But ice cream is one of those things, when you look at it, it just looks fun, and it looks like, well, it can't be too hard either. And I'm a bit creative. I don't like to cook that much, but coming up with new flavors and ideas is something I, you know, you imagine doing. And so it seemed like it would be, without knowing much about it, it seemed like it would be fun. And one thing I did before moving to Hayward, I discovered this ice cream course online. It was, I was doing some research online, you know, while I should have been doing some work. And the University of Reading, wedding outside London had a three-day ice cream course. And I thought, well, this is perfect. And it was in January. We were moving in March. And so I signed up for it. And at the time, I still hadn't resigned. So no one knew that I was doing this. And I took a few days off and I, you know, went to the train station to take the train and trying to avoid seeing anyone I knew from the bank. And I took this course with some professors from their School of Food Bioscience, which talked about the science of ice cream. And then we actually went into their plant room and we made some, using their formulas, an ice cream base and then actually froze it. And I must admit I was a bit at first, the science can be really tricky. You know, it's kind of tricky ice cream. You know, it's frozen and it can easily melt. And if you don't freeze it properly, it may not turn out very well. So it was a bit frightening. But once I arrived in Hayward, under the tutelage of Bruce West, the owner and seller of the ice cream shop, I learned the ropes. And he actually continued to help for a number of years and still does help sometimes. So I got used to it, and I have plenty of help, and you know we've done quite well with it, and have expanded the number of flavors we offer. And even though the three-day course probably wasn't, you know, all I needed,
what did it feel like when you know you'd signed the papers, you went into the shop for the first time, and this was yours, this was your future?
Well, this is, I described this in the book. It's from the very beginning. And we had only been in Hayward really in the summer and the fall, which are lovely times with lots of people. And so this was the middle or towards the end of March. It was really around the first day of spring. And the closing completion of the purchase was going to be at the end of March. And so we decided we would get to town and we'd go in for I called it the handover meeting. And we went in and of course, it's – well, it is winter. There's snow on the ground. And we weren't really after 25 years of being away, I forgot that spring arrived rather late to the area. And so when we left London, there were daffodils blooming and spring was in the air. But in Hayward, there was still plenty of snow on the ground. And so there was no one around. And we walked in and it was just very quiet. And then we began to notice that, you know, the place could use a bit of work. And and we met some of the people involved. And that sort of became one of the interesting things. And I think it was that experience that I thought, this is going to be interesting. One of the characters in the book who was there, his name was Buck, and he was, at the time, he was already in his mid-70s. And he worked at the ice cream shop for the owner, and he was always around, and he turned out to be quite a character. He had his opinions on everything, but he loved the ice cream shop, and we kept him on, and he would help scoop ice cream. He loved making malts, and he was very good at it. And he would do some deliveries. And so in the book, there's a bit of a description of the growing relationship I had with him. Sometimes he was a bit too ornery and cantankerous, but in the end, we got along quite well.
A lot of people kind of go through the beginning stages of what you went through. They go somewhere beautiful on vacation, their lives are stressful, and they think, why don't we just move here? Could we just move here and open a business? Not many people do it because it's hard, but you guys did. Did you ever have a moment where you thought, oh, this has been a horrible mistake, we're in over our heads, why did we do this?
Certainly. Many times. It was something. We knew it was a bit of a risk. We were probably a bit naive in not realizing how much of a risk it was. Fortunately, we came with a fair amount of resources to withstand the downs and also the long winter. And that it took a few years to build the business, especially with the bed and breakfast, where we spent, you know, 2-3 times what we had intended to spend on the renovations, and then we had no customers because it was a brand new business, and it took some time to build that. Fortunately, the ice cream shop, because it was a local institution, did well from the very beginning, and that helped get us through those very lean years at the beginning. But I think in the end, it was always easy to look back at what our lives were like and how out of balance they were, and the easiest thing for me is in the summer. You know, it's a Sunday afternoon, and I'm in the ice cream shop, and I see people. Parents are there with their children, and you see them. You know, they're checking emails because they know they have to get back to the city and they have to go to work the next day. And for me, I just have to get up and put on a new T-shirt and come to work and, you know, do some ordering and check the schedule, and it you know, I certainly I can still appreciate that. And so while at times we wondered whether we did the right thing, there were never any regrets.
You mentioned that you are from the upper Midwest. Dean, though, I gather, isn't. Was there some culture shock for him at first?
Oh, certainly. Dean is British, and although he had traveled in America and had always had a desire to live in America, and to a certain extent, he is quite an extroverted personality, perhaps much more so than I am. So he adapted quite well, but he was often amused by the things that people would do. I mean, I think you know when his first sight of pickled herring in the relish tray. Put him over the edge, as well as they have English are sometimes funny about food. They hate the idea of mixing savory things with sweet things, especially at breakfast time. So when we were at our first dairy breakfast, the Sawyer County Dairy Breakfast, and his job was to put scoop ice cream on top of pancakes that were sitting right next to some sausage links, I thought he may lose his breakfast.
We're talking to Jeff Miller about his move from international lawyer in London to ice cream shop owner in Hayward, Wisconsin. His new book is Scoop: Notes from a Small Ice Cream Shop.
And you can join the conversation. Have you ever made a huge life change like this one? Are you a small town business owner? What is that like? And what do you love about small town life in the North Woods? Or do you have a favorite ice cream flavor that you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Jeff Miller. His new book is called Scoop, and he tells the story of his big move from being an international lawyer at a London bank to owning an ice cream store in Hayward, Wisconsin.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever made that major life decision, making that huge change, walking away from the daily grind to try something new? Or did you walk up to the verge and then get cold feet? Or do you want to share your love of small-town Wisconsin and the North Woods, or maybe just your favorite ice cream flavor? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And let's talk a little bit more about the ice cream. Your book is called Scoop, after all. So how did you get into the business of making that ice cream yourselves? What goes into actually making the ice cream?
Ice cream in small ice cream shops start with a base, and ours is a 14% butterfat sweetened cream. And we make it two ways. We have a very old machine. It's a continuous freezer of about the same age as me, 50 years. And it takes two or three people to operate, but it can produce a lot of ice cream. After our first year, we bought a batch freezer, which most small ice cream shops have, that will produce 9 or 10 gallons of ice cream at a time. And that allows us to make a lot of different flavors. One of the things I would do every winter, though, is try to come up with some new flavors. And for a while, every year we would try to introduce five new flavors. Some of them would be really popular and some of them not so popular. For example, 2 years ago in 2012, it was the 40th anniversary of Watergate. So I came up with an ice cream that I called Remembering Watergate, which was much like the Watergate salad that you may remember from the 70s. It was a pistachio pineapple ice cream with a marshmallow swirl. And it was actually very good, but it was overwhelmingly sweet. And so we had it for the 1 year, and some people really liked it and still ask about it, but that didn't make the cut for 2013. Last year I had an ice cream that I quite liked. It was agave, so we use an agave sweetener rather than and so it was more of a natural sweet, not a vanilla base. And we had a hint of raspberry in it, and we called it Agave Maria because the names are, I think, as important as the ice cream sometime. And while I quite liked it, unfortunately, it was not very popular either. This year, because of the winter, I was busy working with editors at the Minnesota Historical Society Press and revising the book. All my creative energies were focused on that, and I unfortunately didn't come up with any new flavors. So this year, we've reintroduced key lime pie, which we hadn't had out in a few years, and it's been very popular. And I'm also pushing an ice cream that we've had for a number of years, but it was popular at first, but then people sort of seemed to forget about it, and we call it Amazon Treat. And it's an acai berry ice cream with dark chocolate chunks and salted cashews, which is
Zany.
A very
wow.
nice
wow.
Alternative to your strawberry or black cherry.
So what is your best-selling ice cream?
That'd probably be mint chocolate chip, and I think that's just because a big, very popular ice cream in the upper Midwest. But there's an ice cream that Wes has always made called Almost Sinful, and it's a vanilla ice cream with a fudge swirl, chocolate-covered peanuts and walnuts, and that would probably be our number two seller, and it's popular especially with people who have been coming to Wes for 20, 30, 40 years.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Dennis in Wautoma. Dennis, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Congratulations on your success, by the way. It's not easy. My partner and I are basically Chicago people who moved to the Wautoma area. He grew up coming up to the Wild Rose area for most of his childhood all the way up to adolescence, and we became a couple 25 years ago, built a house up here 12 years ago, and then started going into business. We're now in the lodging business. We have seasonal rentals, so we don't do bed and breakfast. And we've been pleasantly surprised by how well-received a gay couple is up here. Even with I'm currently volunteering at the Senior Center here in Wautoma doing the lunch program for them, and you always hear that seniors are the least likely to accept gay people, but frankly, we're not running into that at all. We've been very, very warmly accepted here in this community, and I was pleasantly surprised by that. I'm just wondering what kind of response you've had.
I think we had the very much the same response. I mean, we've in 9 years, and this will be my 10th summer at the ice cream shop. We've really never had any problem. There's one kind of amusing story is after a few years. I have a lady who works in the ice cream shop in the off season, and she told me that an older lady came in, and I recognized the older lady because she drove a car with a lot of bumper stickers, very noticeable bumper stickers that you sometimes see. And she came in and she asked Vivian, who worked for me. She said, "Now you know about those owners, don't you?" And Vivian said, "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, you know." And basically making very obvious what she was referring to. And she said, "But I just need an ice cream cone." And so I think that was as closest to any sort of negative reaction we've had.
Ice cream overrides all, apparently.
Yeah. I think it's just generally, in the upper Midwest, people are very, especially up in Hayward, people are very, people are there for a number of different reasons. And they come here often in the middle of their life to do something else. And so people respect others overall, we didn't really give that aspect of it much thought because we sort of thought if we can make it in London or New York, we can do it anywhere. And we didn't really think about it much. Perhaps we should have, but in the end, it wasn't an issue.
So do you feel pretty embedded in the community now, just in terms of moving from the city and being outsiders to the region to being part of a community? Did that take a while?
I think it did, and one of the things I address in the book is sort of how I felt. For me, it was a bit like coming home because I had grown up in the area, so it was certainly more like growing up, in Minnesota than living in London. But I felt a bit like Rip Van Winkle that I hadn't been back in 25 years, and some things had changed. I was very surprised to see that you could buy the New York Times in the local supermarket, which amazed me. But at the same thing, it takes an hour and a half to drive to Target. So it took a bit of adjustment, but things were so familiar to me from like the local bakery, from scratch bakery to the high school, which looked exactly like my high school. So things were coming back, and I felt a bit comfortable, even though I still feel like a bit of an observer. And the way I put it is, though, while I may not feel part of the community all the time, it is certainly part of me. So now when I go away, I'm always thinking about my life in Hayward. And when I go to a city now, I'm just sort of, confused by the traffic and the noise and why you can't get a salad and baked potato with your dinner free of charge.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. We'll go to Michelle now in Fort Atkinson. Michelle, hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. So I'm a big kid at heart, and I love bubblegum ice cream. I love fancy flavors, but my heart always goes back to that. So congratulations on your success.
Well, thank you. The
biggest thing for me so far is establishing myself in a community. I've been a commuter for 15 years, and the company that I worked for closed down, and not only losing 70%+ of our income in one day, I decided to throw my hat in and start my own business. So what kind of advice can you give to people that are starting a business in a small community that they may not be embedded in?
I think to reach out, I find that a lot of groups, organizations will come to us to ask for assistance from times, and I do whatever I can to help them as a way of getting the word out. And also it gives a message that you are part of the community and want to help them. So I if anyone asks me, and I will give them cards for free ice cream cones that they can give away in, as door prizes or raffles, and just making yourself known to other community groups. I'm fortunate that I employ a lot of students, and so that's a great way of making yourself known, and because they have lots of friends and their parents and they all talk, and so it's a good way of getting support that way.
Jeff, I've spent some time in northern Wisconsin and in Hayward, a little bit of time there, and I've always been curious about the winters. What happens when the tourists go home and the snow comes? What is it like to be up in the North Woods in the winter?
It's very quiet and very long. One thing that we did at first, and I thought we should do this, is embrace it by taking up cross-country skiing, because, of course, with the American Birkebeiner, skiing is a big deal in Hayward. And so we did take lessons, and I wasn't very good. And so I sort of gave that up until this year when I got out again, but I'm still not very good, even after, you know, after not skiing for 8 years, I'm still not very good, and I fell down, and I won't do that again. So what I did is I basically wrote a book. I spent my winters writing Scoop, and it gave me something to do, and it was worthwhile. And I think that is the key to find, especially when you run tourist businesses, seasonal businesses, is finding something to do. The other thing, this past year, I took 2 months and I went to California. So that was another way of dealing with winter in Hayward.
Jeff, you're an ice cream guy. Before we let you go, what is your go-to ice cream at your shop?
That is a hard question, because I'm a bit like, that would be like, I feel a bit like, you know, Meryl Streep and the Nazis are after me. I love the caramel ice creams. I love the salted caramel. I love the toffee treat. I made one and actually brought to the studio here today, Coconut Magic Bar, which reminds me of my youth. And my favorite treat was the 7-layer Magic Bar. It's a coconut dulce de leche ice cream with walnuts, graham cracker, butterscotch, and chocolate chips.
Wow. I wish you were at that studio.
Yeah.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jeff Miller. He's the author of Scoop, Notes from a Small Ice Cream Shop.